right, so while we're waiting for this to work itself out, my name's Catherine Craig. I'm here from Common Ground, as well as the 100,000 Homes Campaign. I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Laura Carson-Weinstein from Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, and Dr. Maria Raven from HHC Hospitals and NYU Medical Center. None of us have anything to disclose today. What we're going to be talking about is some practical interventions that have been set up across those two different cities, as well as some others, to bridge effectively the healthcare and housing and street outreach systems so that we can more effectively provide care and housing to people who are experiencing homelessness. So we'll run through a bit of definitions, just in case that would be helpful, around permanent supportive housing. And you'll hear about some specific interventions and their impact on people's health and their use of the healthcare systems. So just to give you a bit of context, across the United States, each year, over 400,000 people sleep in shelters and on the streets across a given year. A quarter of them are what we refer to as people who are experiencing chronic homelessness. So these are folks who are sleeping out on the streets or in shelters for a year or more consecutively. There's been meta-analyses that have shown that people experiencing chronic homelessness are 3 to 4 times more likely to die prematurely than their peers in the housed population. So the impact of homelessness on health is profound and really compels us all to as quick action as possible. There's also huge impacts on the healthcare system that Dr. Scott was able to cover well in the frequent use discussion earlier. I just want to pull your eye to the last bullet point here. So Dr. Raven, with some colleagues in New York, was able to show that people who were frequently visiting emergency room and frequently being admitted to care, of those who were frequently using and were covered by Medicaid, fully 2/3 of them were either homeless or unstably housed. So the impact to the systems is also really profound. I want to pause a moment and define what permanent supportive housing is, just in case that's unclear to anyone. What we're talking about is permanent housing where individuals are offered a tenancy like you or I are, where they have a lease with their name on it, they can come and go as they please, and there's supports that are offered on site. Those supports are usually in the form of social work, case management, this sort of thing, to help people to reintegrate back into living inside and reorder their lives. We can see here, this is a demonstration showing what the per night over the course of a year cost would be for people experiencing homelessness, staying in hospital beds, incredibly expensive, psych hospital beds, very expensive, a lot of costs racked up in the judicial system as well. And what we see over on the left is the average U.S. cost of permanent supportive housing. That includes the tenancy support, the rental support, as well as the supports in the form of social work, case managers on site. So even taking into account the cost of the intervention, permanent supportive housing, welcoming people into their own home, is a much more efficient option. So effectively, we all win as a society when we help people back into their own homes. There's also a host of studies across the states, about 12, that have shown that after being welcomed back into permanent supportive housing and retaining that housing for about a year, in the second year after placement and housing, people use the healthcare system in ways that we would like them to, basically. So they're not relying on emergency rooms as much, they're being admitted to care much less frequently, and they are using a whole lot more outpatient mental health and physical health care out in the community. Clearly at a much lower cost. And even when we account for the uptick in the outpatient costs, there's still a decrease in overall healthcare costs in the range of 60%. What we see also across those 12 studies is overall cost savings per person per year of somewhere between $1,100 and $18,000. I actually think that's pretty conservative based on what we've been finding among our colleagues around the states who are doing some interesting work in this, and you'll hear a bit more about that in detail in a moment. So I want to share with you also, let me just see if it's next. Okay. So what are we doing about this? My organization, Common Ground, along with a whole lot of national partners, in July of this year launched the 100,000 Homes Campaign, which aims within 3 years to absolutely end chronic homelessness across the states by welcoming people into housing as quickly as possible. And what we've done is we've, with colleagues around the country who have been working on identifying people who are most at risk of dying if they experience continued homelessness, to help them to come back into housing just as quickly as possible. And so we've identified some areas that communities can shore up their efforts, basically, and both how to identify folks who are most at risk of dying, all the way through how we can match them up to the housing supply that's existing, how we can rejigger the housing supply that's out there to allot it towards those most likely to die if they're left out on the streets, and various work around helping people to sustain that housing and to improve their health overall. I'm going to just hop back to this one for a moment. The Vulnerability Index is a tool that we've developed with partners, again, and based on longitudinal research out of Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless, where they looked at what illnesses and risk factors put people at most risk of dying with continued homelessness. And so this information that you see before, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but this is based on nearly 13,000 completed surveys across 27 cities in the states. The impact of homelessness on folks' health is just absolutely profound, and we all need to be, you know, as you all know, as you're all here, there's a real urgency in helping folks to sort this out. Probably also of interest, among everyone that we survey, the average length of homelessness is about 5 years. So certainly everybody that we're surveying fits that definition of chronic homelessness. Among those who are most vulnerable, they've stayed outside for nearly a full year longer. So certainly the length of homelessness has an impact. I want to share with you a couple of folks who we've met along the way. All the photos that we share in presentations have been agreed. The folks in the photos have said, yes, please do share my photos and presentations so that people can understand more about homelessness. This is a fellow we met in Phoenix, helped him back inside, and the health impacts are just profound. This woman also was in Phoenix. She had a housewarming party at her new apartment and dressed up for that. This fellow's name is Ed. We met him on the streets of Skid Row, and even on Skid Row, he was one of the top five most vulnerable people, which I have to tell you is saying a whole lot. He was 30 years homeless, and to all eyes, you know, could be, oh, well, maybe he's choosing, you know, to be homeless. Maybe this is what he prefers. Maybe he doesn't want a home. Absolutely off the mark. He was suffering with multiple overlapping chronic physical health needs. Living with a pretty serious, very serious alcohol addiction, helped him back inside, and here he is. So wanted to share with you also, just before I turn it over to Maria, what we've done at Common Ground is pull together a network of colleagues across the states who are working to implement the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's Triple Aim Initiative, focusing it on people experiencing homelessness. So what we were all doing is coming up with interventions to improve folks' health, improve their experience of the care system, while decreasing overall healthcare costs. And with that, I'll turn it over to Maria.
Hi, so what I'm gonna go over here is baseline characteristics of, excuse me, homeless enrollees in a program that I oversee in New York City Hospital to Home. And then compared to also clients that are enrolled in the Pathways to Housing program in Philadelphia, in addition to non-homeless hospital home enrollees and more general samples of folks in Philadelphia, New York City, and nationally. And the main things to highlight here is the high chronic disease burden that these folks have in comparison to more general populations. They have very, very high burdens of behavioral health issues, both substance use and mental health, high rates of social isolation. They use the emergency department quite a bit for primary care, and if you look at the very bottom, they have very low self-reported health in comparison to the general population. So the program I oversee in New York City is called Hospital to Home. It's actually a New York State Department of Health-sponsored program for fee-for-service Medicaid patients that generate high costs due to frequent use of the health system. And it's an intensive care management and coordination system for these high-risk frequent users. And what we really aim to do is sort of take what I think we all know as silos of care. So you've got the patient and then the healthcare system that doesn't talk to housing, that doesn't talk to mental health, it doesn't talk to substance use, unfortunately. And what our program does is bring all those things together for the patient by using community-based care managers, some dedicated primary care physician time, social workers, and a dedicated housing coordinator to really sort of be the glue to bring everyone onto the same page for these patients and help them work within this very fragmented system. And just to give you an example of one of the patients we work with that's pretty typical, Ms. W is a 43-year-old female. She suffers from morbid obesity, insulin-dependent diabetes with complications, hepatitis C, hypertension, asthma, tobacco, history of IV drug use, and also history of depression with past suicide attempts. When we met her prior to enrollment, she was homeless in a shelter and had been for quite some time. And as you may know, there are a lot of often case managers that work in shelters with patients toward housing, and what we're finding is a lot of the patients we enroll actually have case managers in shelters or outside of shelters, and things just aren't quite happening for them even with that, so that our added services are actually helpful to move things along. She had frequent hospital admissions for out-of-control diabetes, and I wanted to highlight this case because we see quite a few patients that do have diabetes, and for especially those that are homeless, it's extremely, extremely difficult to maintain any semblance of good health, especially if they're insulin dependent. You know, insulin needs to be refrigerated, and you need to check frequent blood sugars, and it becomes really impossible. So we provided her with a community-based care manager who provided a cellular phone. That's something we do for our patients. We provide cell phones for patients who don't have them and pay for minutes. This allows us to give appointment reminders, a lot of moral support. We connected her to our primary care physician and various subspecialists. She got onto the house load of our housing coordinator, who helped work to move her housing application that wasn't really going anywhere through. We actually helped her move into permanent supportive housing with a home health aide for medication assistance, and we also hold monthly support groups, which she attends. And this is a before and after graph, 12 months pre, 12 months post, to show that her hospitalizations went from 6 to 1. Outpatient appointments increased greatly, and we can see that, and I think especially in the first year with someone that hasn't been well controlled, especially diabetes and other conditions. This is something we'd expect, and it's okay, again, because it's less costly and better for the patient. She did have an increase in ED visits, and interestingly, ED visits, when you see them here, are counted only if they're treat and release visits. So what this may mean is that she was able to be seen in the emergency department and then released because she had these existing supports now. And the cost to Medicaid decreased by over $62,000. And now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Weinstein.
Thank you. And I just want to thank my colleague and research partner, Benjamin Henwood, for letting us be the woman power group up here. But he has done as much or more of the work. And Abby Santana, who is our research coordinator at Thomas Jefferson. At Pathways to Housing, we're a housing first organization that ends homelessness for people with psychiatric disability by moving them directly from the streets to apartments of their own, and providing supports through an interdisciplinary assertive community treatment team that you've heard about in some of the other presentations. Through an innovative partnership with the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, a primary care physician, which just happens to be myself, was embedded, very fortunately able to be embedded into the care team to provide both on-site and in the field primary care for the clients in collaboration with the psychiatrists and the nurses and the rest of the team, and also to provide linkages with the Academic Health Center and with my academic department that is an NCQA recognized medical home. This is our overall framework, and I'd love to talk with people more about it at the end since we're short on time, or you can come to our poster presentation at 2:30, which gives a lot more details. But at this point, I'd like to now turn to a short clip of a collective action video that we made as part of a community-based participatory research project with our client colleagues at Pathways to Housing, with the intention of better understanding and then actually getting the word out about the critical relationship between housing and health. You can watch the full video on YouTube, and now we can watch part of it.
So So we can take any questions you all have now.
I'm curious, and I think you said this, but on the two, on the different programs, it's still the vulnerability index that identifies who sort of either the hospital or I wasn't sure how they get recruited.
So my program, it's New York State Department of Health sponsored, and we actually use a previously validated predictive case finding algorithm that takes data, 5 years of data, and looks back at previous patterns of hospital and ED outpatient use and diagnoses, and uses that to predict the risk of future hospital admission. It was developed by John Billings, and you guys can look it up, but it's nice because it allows you to target the patients that are high risk and are very likely to continue to be high risk, so that you're not necessarily spending resources on people that are going to be high use for a little period of time and then just kind of regress to the mean on their own.
Yeah, we work with existing outreach teams in Philadelphia, so to document the chronic homelessness piece, and then those folks that were known to the mental health system would qualify for our program, or we'd go out and actually do independent psychiatric evaluation, and then we would qualify for our program.
Some of the cost numbers were really impressive, obviously, that you had demonstrated on various costs of treatment for both. For that one individual, Ms. W, who you had highlighted, just for a ballpark, did you know what the intervention costs associated with her were?
Yeah, pretty much, actually. I mean, I can tell you because we had to back into our budget from the state. So for each patient, we get a monthly care coordination fee of $291.50 per month. And then we have a little bit of supplementary grant money that I have from another source, from a foundation source. So all in, I think with that extra grant money, it's about $3,800 a year.
So it's like just less than $30 per dollar invested.
$30 per?
Saved per dollar invested. Like the return on investment is very high.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'd have to think about that, but I think that's probably true. Okay, yes. But yeah, I mean, that's a pretty stark contrast. And I think overall, we're looking at some individual before and after cases for patients that have been enrolled for a year now. And the state actually has a whole control group that they're doing an analysis. But we're finding that some patients are costing much less, and there are also some patients that are costing more in the first year. I think that we're going to have an overall savings because we're going to save more than we end up spending in that first year. But there are some patients who in the first year end up costing more because of undiscovered disease diagnoses. And, you know, they decide to go to rehab for the first time and they go 5 times. You know.
Last follow-up there as well. What has been your retention rate after this first year?
Good question. Of those that we enroll, we do have some loss to follow-up, which for us, programmatically, it's if we can't find them after extensive trying for like 3 months. It's not a huge number. I don't know if we know. We were just trying to get that number.
I think it's probably it's going to be around 50% that end up voluntarily. Well, I should say it's either voluntarily disenrolling or they end up going into managed care or some higher level of.
Or they die. Like we have some. About 15% have to disenroll for some reason, and then a percentage of those is because we can't find them. If we found them again, we could re-enroll them. So it's probably in the realm of 10% or a little less. That's Rachel Davis, our project manager.
You know, I so many times I wish we had like an extra half hour for all the people that presented. But I believe there's a way that you can go online to the e-version of things if people miss something or the context for people. But thank you all for coming. Did anybody else have any questions about it?
Can I just make one quick follow-up plug? The 100,000 Homes campaign is open to absolutely any community that would want to be a part of it. And please feel free to go ahead and look at www.100khomes.org. Contact me if you like, or the other folks listed on there.
Actually, how many people here know if their community is already in the 100,000 Homes? I think there's probably a lot of people.
Cool. Let's get everybody go in team. This room on the 100,000 Home campaign by the end of the day.
You know, I want to ask one question. There's a lot of brain power in the room, too. But the issue of healthcare reform, I keep having this idea that it's really going to be great, and some of my other pals are telling me there could be challenges with managed care, but that they're, in terms of linking in some of these programs and more reimbursement, I don't know, any sort of things we should be alert about all this to take advantage of or to be concerned about? Or?
Yeah, so there's a couple things that we have our eye on coming around, and one of those is obviously the Medicaid expansion is going to help folks that we're working with, but that's not until, as you all know, 2014. In the meantime, federally qualified health clinics are going to get increasingly more and more boosts of dollars, and what we're looking at is how can we help to align with FQHCs to help them to understand that it might make sense for them to spend some of their dollars supporting people in housing rather than seeing them as they're still experiencing homelessness. So that's something that we're looking at. We also really think that there's some huge opportunities here with the campaign being such a wide-reaching net that as we figure out ways that really help to support people to maintain that housing and improve their health, HHS is interested in hearing what those interventions are and in thinking about how they might be able to rejigger financing. So it's something that we're hopeful that we'll be able to have an impact on in the not too distant long run.
I would also add to that that the payments for disproportionate share hospitals, so a lot of like the city hospitals that you and I work in, are potentially going to go away, and that's going to be a burden that they're going to have to bear. And so hopefully the Medicaid expansion will help with that. But I think right now, for a lot of these patients that have frequent admissions, there's no incentive for the hospitals to do anything because they get paid every time they come in. So it's like a boon to them, and there's no incentive to try to, you know, to reduce those admissions. But I think with healthcare reform, with, you know, increasing payments for medical homes and accountable care organizations, a lot of the hospitals, I know HHC is looking to sort of bring people in and change the hospital into more of a program where they're more focused on outpatient care, because there's a sense that those sorts of things with the payment for admissions and all that kind of stuff is going to go away. And so I think people are looking towards a more integrated care model so they can get the higher payments for being a medical home or NCQA approved and all that sort of thing.
The only thing I have to say about that is still, in because we've been tracking how the core group of folks that comes to see me, how well do they do accessing my practice, which is a medical home, and the specialty care there, and we still have 30% no-show rate for care there. But for me, you know, if they, there's a lot of opportunities for care because I'm on site, I can go out and see people in the field, that's not really a recognized payment mechanism right now.
Correct.
But the flexibility of that is profound, because you can reach people that you wouldn't ever reach, that could never make an appointment. Not to say in 6 months or 2 years they won't just be going to the doctor's office with their card and getting their prescriptions, but in that transitional period, you have to have some flexible outreach, either through physicians or nurse practitioners, physician's assistants.
Well, it'll be interesting, because one of the things that people don't talk about, but parity was part of that.
Yeah, right.
That could either, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see, but you would imagine that part of parity is going to mean that some of these visits are going to have to be reimbursed.
Mm-hmm.
But it also could possibly be a huge cost that quickly gets us in trouble. And
but it's quality dollars.
It is. I just think we don't have. You're talking about. I just don't think we have a mechanism. We don't have a mechanism currently to deal with that, and so. You know, I think it would behoove us all to start thinking about what those mechanisms might be, because I think Medicaid isn't going to capture it accurately.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, there's institutional costs associated that are probably not going to be reimbursed. So I think we should all think about what parity is going to mean and how it's going to look.
And who might be linked with anybody who does policy or that we can grab their ear and say, this is how it might impact this population.
Thank you.